No one is pleased with this performance, and no one can be particularly pleased with the stock market. Keep in mind that only stocks are in negative territory. Short-term treasuries, money markets, and bonds, of course, are generally positive for the year. For example, most of us have a balanced asset allocation. Now, with reference to the stock portion of that asset allocation, I, of course, believe in passive portfolios and indexes, but we all have a fixed income portion of our portfolio as well. And most folks, for example, would have 60, perhaps even 70% of their assets in stocks, maybe 30, 40% or more in fixed income. It depends on one's own comfort level. But because bonds and fixed income are slightly positive for the year, the actual overall portfolio that you are probably holding at the moment, while it would still be negative, isn't probably nearly as negative as you would think. Because if you are down 7 or 8% in your stocks for the year and 60% of your portfolio are in stocks and you have a little bit of fixed income and that's positive for the year, probably your overall portfolio is down somewhere between 4 and 4.5% for the year. And while these numbers, of course, are troubling, it's an important lesson of investing to keep in mind, especially if you are entering the distribution phase at retirement. And that is to say that if you're going to begin withdrawals from a portfolio, whether it's an after-tax portfolio, a 403B, a 401K, an IRA, one should have approximately 30 months of funds in those portfolios to withdraw, which are not tied up in stocks, because you simply don't want to put yourself in a position of being forced to liquidate stocks when they are heading south. That's the issue. So you always want to have the fixed income portion of your portfolio so that you can take money out of that fixed income portion at retirement, if indeed you need to, so that you don't have to hemorrhage stocks as they continue to appear negative. And generally, as one approaches retirement, a portfolio consisting of 40% fixed income or more really ameliorates the impact of a negative stock market. Also, I want to continue to counsel prudence when investing in fixed income. Currently, FDIC-insured CDs and U.S. Treasury instruments, I think, make the most sense. These are basically very defensive positions. You're going to be disappointed at the interest rates currently being paid in these instruments, somewhere between 3% and perhaps as high as 4%. But I think these are the prudent positions at the current time as credit markets continue to sort themselves out. For example, the current 7-day yield on Vanguard's 100% Treasury money market is 3.24%. No one's going to get rich. We're not even keeping up with inflation in that particular money market. But again, we have to think of it as a defensive position. Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that mortgage rates are extraordinarily competitive at the moment. 15-year rates are in the low 5% range. And in fact, just about 10 days ago, they were below 5%. And 30-year rates approximate 5.5% to 5.75%. From an historical perspective, these really are quite excellent rates. And with home prices continuing to decline in many areas of the country, it's certainly a reasonable time to consider a purchase, especially when you can take advantage of two elements: an interest rate environment where you're going to be able to procure an excellent mortgage, and a lower home price. Interestingly enough, however, real estate prices in certain very what I would call hot metropolitan areas, such as Manhattan, are actually increasing. What's happening? Foreign buyers, especially buyers from the UK, are very, very active in this market. After all, the exchange rate is almost 2-1. It takes about $2 for one British pound. And as a result, UK buyers are looking at America as very cheap, as literally on sale as a result of this currency differentiation. So certain areas that you would think maybe would also be involved in this housing downturn, not so in certain metropolitan areas such as Manhattan. Now, I'd like to switch topics for just a moment and turn to the issue, something that I visited, about a year and a half ago, and I think it's apropos to bring it up again, and that is identity theft. It's now becoming an even larger problem. It's always been a massive problem, but especially in periods of slow growth in the U.S. economy, especially in times of rising unemployment, which of course we are currently experiencing, that is when identity theft really geometrically increases. So I would urge everyone to call up their own credit report online. This is a website that I'm going to give you. It's a free website. It doesn't cost anything. It's called www.annualcreditreport.com. As I mentioned, this is a free government-sponsored site which enables each of us to pull up our credit reports free once a year from one or all three of the major credit reporting services. The three major credit reporting services are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Pick your poison. You can choose any of them. Important to understand, when you call up your own credit report by going on one of these sites, then this does not impact your credit score. Also, once a year, you are entitled to a free credit report from each of these credit reporting agencies. So, for example, every 4 months, you could go online. The first time you go to Equifax, the second time you go to Experian, the third time you go to TransUnion, and then you start the whole process over again. So actually, you can monitor for free your own credit by calling up on a four-month basis each credit report from one of these credit reporting agencies. And as I mentioned again, this has no negative impact on your credit score, and you can quickly tell if something is inaccurate or troubling in your report. Now, one additional caveat. While you can call up the report and you can print it off, these credit reporting agencies do not provide you with a credit score. They won't tell you whether your score is 750, 775, 825, 850, 510, for example. 850 is almost a perfect score. It is theoretically impossible, but that would be the top score. Any score from 750 above, that probably suggests to you that you have sterling credit. Now, identity theft occurs when someone uses your name, obviously, your Social Security number, your date of birth, or other identifying information without authority and to commit fraud. For example, someone may have committed fraud and identity theft by using your personal information to open up a credit card account, or perhaps even get a loan in your name. It's hard to believe, but this happens literally once every 2 minutes now in America. Also, there is something called the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which gives you specific rights when you think you have been a victim of identity theft. For example, you have the right to ask that nationwide consumer reporting agencies, such as Experian, Equifax, or TransUnion, place something called a fraud alert in your file to let all potential creditors know that you may be a victim of identity theft. And a fraud alert makes it very, very difficult for someone else to get credit in your name because it tells creditors to follow certain procedures to protect you. Basically, they're going to have to call you up. They're going to have to run you down. You're going to have to verify all the information. Now, there are two kinds of fraud alerts. There is the initial fraud alert, which basically you can call up, put in your file, and that lasts 90 days. Then there is the more permanent fraud alert that you can file. You have to provide a certain amount of information, paperwork, etc., but that can be placed in your file for a very substantial period of time, up to 7 years, especially if you are having major problems. Also, if you have been a victim of identity theft or believe you are a victim of identity theft after looking at your report, you have the right to free copies of all information in your file called a file disclosure. Now, that file disclosure is different from your credit report. That file disclosure has to be made available by the three credit reporting agencies. You can then take a look at it, and then basically you can determine much more quickly whether or not you indeed have been a victim and how to solve that problem and how to figure out how to repair that credit. So there are some things that you can do, and I simply bring this to your attention at this point because as we appear to be moving toward a recession, if you believe Greenspan, Bernanke, whatever, the bottom line is the economy has slowed, unemployment is rising, and those two elements are the perfect storm for additional identity theft. So go to annualcreditreport.com and choose your poison, TransUnion, Experian, Equifax, and you can call up your own credit report. Well, there you have it, David, a little bit about the stock market, a little bit about our couch potato portfolio, equities, etc. And, of course, I'd be happy to answer further questions on the issues I've raised or any topics that our listeners would like me to try to tackle.
Very good. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, you just pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. This is our regular monthly show on personal finance. We do it once a month, always on Friday with Dave. We have a couple of people who are ready to go, so we will start with someone who is on line number one right here. Hello.
Good morning. I am a longtime investor in open-end mutual funds, and so I know how they work pretty well, and I think I know what a closed-end fund is, even though I have never invested in one. But what I don't understand is the difference between closed-end funds and exchange-traded funds. I also don't understand how either one makes their distributions, since you have to buy them through a broker. So I'll listen.
Well, an exchange-traded fund is an ETF. It's really a tracking stock, if you will, that basically mirrors a particular index. In fact, one of the most interesting ETFs that I've been looking at, and I've really been sitting on the sidelines, probably sat on the sidelines too long, a number of ETFs now are offering what are called material and industrial product ETFs. In fact, Vanguard has one, and a number of other folks have them as well. And this particular ETF really is an ETF that tracks companies that are involved in forest products, metals, concrete, all of the things that go into building materials. It's been a very, very hot asset class. It's not really part of our couch potato portfolio. In fact, it's been up 20, 25, 30% on a compounded basis over the last 3 years. And if you believe the voracious appetite for building materials will continue, especially in China and India, that might be an example of a particular tracking stock that you might want to buy. So an ETF, think of it more like a stock as opposed to an index. That's an example of an ETF. Now, closed-end mutual funds are basically, they also trade really a bit more like a stock because there are only a certain number of shares in a closed-end mutual fund. An open-end mutual fund allows you to buy more and more shares. But in a closed-end mutual fund, there are a finite number of shares, and hence there is less liquidity in that type of mutual fund. So what you find is that a number of these closed-end mutual funds often sell at a discount to their actual underlying value. It's a very interesting area. It's an area which has to be studied carefully, and there are some experts in this particular area. One particular firm in the Chicago area, River North Capital Management, has a mutual fund which basically is involved in studying and analyzing and investing in these kinds of closed-end mutual funds. But essentially, they're a mutual fund. They're sort of like a normal mutual fund. The only difference is you can't buy additional shares. You have to buy shares that were originally issued. So if the original issue was 1 million shares, that's all that's available. In an open-end mutual fund, you can always purchase more and more shares, and the money manager will simply allocate your money into those current positions. So that's a little bit about ETFs, a little bit about closed-end mutual funds. Hope that answers the question.
I was also wondering about how distributions are made from those.
Well, let's see. ETFs would be a share of stock, so you would receive a dividend on the ETF. And on a closed-end mutual fund, if the shares declare dividends, let's see. I have to think about that one. I'm not sure. I believe that you would receive actually the dividend. Well, I'm not sure. I have to check because I'm not in closed-end mutual funds. Either you would receive them in the form of shares or cash. So I'll have to look that one up for you, and I'll have to answer that question on the next program. Or if someone holds a number of these closed-end mutual funds, by all means, call in. So I'll have to check that answer.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll go here to another caller. This would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Just a comment on your the identity theft. I don't know what you're feeling about it, but in Illinois, you can actually get a freeze. It is permanent, but you can get a window of opportunity in terms of a PIN number. But it does freeze your, on all three. And it's free for over 65, and I think it's $10 per, what they call them, those agencies, to have it done. So I don't know what your feeling about that is.
Well, the minute you place a fraud alert on your account and you call one of the three reporting agencies, they immediately report it out to the other two major credit agencies. So that is a free service. The freeze I'm not familiar with, do you have that currently?
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what happens there is that nobody can, it's a permanent freeze.
Okay.
And, what's happened is that individual states have actually, the reporting agencies aren't crazy about this idea. So what happened is that the state of Illinois put it in, I think it was last year, as of January 1. And so what you do is you have to then, it's by mail. And, and in fact, there's a web address for that. For each individual. Of course, the procedures for them are different for each one. You know, you have to supply this or a copy of this.
Sure.
You know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
I recommend that if you do it, to do it by certified mail, because sometimes what happens is you don't want that lost, that information, and you want to verify that it got there. Some are real quick about responding and put the freeze on it, and then what they'll do is they verify the fact you got the freeze, and they'll also give you a PIN number. And you can open it just temporarily for a day or so, for some reason, if you wanted to get a credit card or, whatever. And then it goes back on. So.
Okay, and the freeze, the information is forwarded to whom?
Yeah, each individual, who are the names of the...
Oh, the three credit reporting agencies.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you have to do them individually.
Okay.
And there is a website for each individual one and instructions of how they want it done.
All right.
And
that's permanent, and that's even more of a lock on your account.
Right. You can sleep even better.
All right. And were you motivated to do this because of identity theft?
Sure. And the other one is if you're retired, it's free.
Well, that's even better.
Yeah. And in some states, I think you can even do it by telephoning, but it depends on the way the law was written, in other words, in each state.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, it has to be written. Again, the game is that each one, some of it's Social Security number plus this and that.
Sure.
Maybe it's a copy of something or other and
sure.
All that kind of stuff.
Well, I think that's good advice, and the notion of sending it in certified mail return receipt makes very good sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Just a few quick questions. One is I'm still an amateur in this thing. For example, if it was an equity index and the estimated annual expense was 0.480, that would actually be two decimal points then over, right, if you multiply the amount of money that's in there?
I'm sorry. Give me the number again.
0.480%. That's actually.
Right. That's less than one-half of 1%.
Okay. There we go.
Right. Okay?
Okay.
That's the way you want to think of it.
Now, the inflation rate for 2007 was how much? Do you know?
Yes. If you look at the Wall Street Journal under money rates, they claim... The claim is, and this is from the Bureau of Government Labor Statistics, about 4 to 4.1. That would have been the Consumer Price Index over the last 12 months. Now, no one's going to convince me that the cost of my food and the cost of my gasoline only went up 4.1%. But that's the published number that we utilize.
Okay. And then finally, I remember, I don't know whether it's been a year or, you know, time goes so quickly. And you do a great job, very informed program. I just look forward to this. You mentioned two books in terms of understanding. I think it was investment or the financial markets or something around there. Do you recall that? There was like a primer.
Probably. I love the little book called The Wall Street Journal Guide to Money and Investing.
Okay.
It's about a 175-page read, lots of colored pictures, very, very easy. I think it's about $15 in the bookstores, probably on Amazon, The Wall Street Journal Guide to Money and Investing. I think that's a just an excellent background book.
Okay, and then do you recall that you had another one too or not?
Probably did, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. I'm thinking of some of the books that I recommended. One was Essential Economics, but I'm not sure that would have been the book that I had recommended under that particular circumstance. I'll have to look it up.
Okay. All right. Well, there's always next month.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Just real quick, let me ask you this question, because you mentioned that you can get a free copy of your credit report from these agencies, the three agencies.
Yes.
And it doesn't cost anything. Now, also, though, if people have seen, obviously, these agencies, they're trying to find a way to make some money on this.
Yes.
So they will provide various kinds of other services and
Absolutely.
Information to you for a fee.
Absolutely.
One of those would be your credit score.
And it will be advertised the moment you
That's
go
right.
on that site.
So if you want these other things, they will provide that information, but it will cost you money. Is there some particular reason why you would want to know your credit score?
Well, perhaps. One is in a better position to negotiate interest rate if one knows their credit score. So, for example, if you were going to finance an automobile, finance some kind of consumer type of product, or indeed even look at the interest rate that you can receive on a mortgage, it's the old story. The higher the credit score, the lower the interest rate. So you do have some bargaining power if you know that credit score. So, for example, if you have a very high credit score and you go in and you're negotiating on an automobile and then you have the opportunity to lease the car, finance the car, and you look at those interest rates, you might come back and say, wait a second, I have a very, very high credit score. Those interest rates don't seem reasonable. You should have lower interest rates. So there is some negotiating, but they're not going to tell you that unless you know your own credit score. So if you're going to make some major purchase, yes. Now, as part of the application fee for a residential mortgage, obviously when you sign the paperwork to apply for a mortgage, you are signing paperwork that enables your lender, your mortgage banker, your mortgage broker to pull that credit report. And interestingly enough, here's something that most people don't understand. Often when you are going to procure a new mortgage or you're going to refinance your house, the credit score will be pulled from all three reporting agencies. Now, so let's assume that you have 750 and 700 and 700. So, and that's very possible, the three credit reporting agencies could come up with different numbers. Well, which number do you use? Now, you would think that you would take the three scores and you would average the three scores. That's usually not the way it's done. It's usually the middle score. So if you had 750 and two 700s, the score would be 700 that would be utilized for the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines for procuring a mortgage.
All right. We have some other callers here. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580, and our guest is David Sinno. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I, and once a month, it's always on Friday, we talk about money management, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller, someone here on the campus on our line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Next month, for the first time ever, I'm going to be traveling overseas, and I was just wondering about exchange rates and, you know, where should I go to exchange my money? Should I do it here or wait till I get, I'm going to England, and or should I just use a credit card while I'm there? What advice can you give me?
Wow, that is a tough one. That is asked every day. I had a student just 2 days ago talking about the fact that his beloved, let's put it that way, was going to spend a year studying at Cambridge, and it was going to cost a lot of money, and should she be essentially transferring dollars today into pounds, and what's the least expensive way to do that? Unfortunately, for the typical traveler, there aren't a lot of good alternatives. Typically, my research has shown that you are better off waiting till you are there to essentially exchange dollars for pounds, as opposed to the other way. But usually the best deals are putting things on credit cards. It has worked the best. The exchange rate has been better on credit cards than the 3-5% markup when you exchange dollars for pounds when you are either in the U.S. or over there. So I'm afraid that there aren't a lot of good ideas other than if you are a major trader where you can hedge. And even that, of course, is fraught with difficulties because it costs money to execute a trade and then you have holding costs, etc. So I've talked to a lot of people who do a lot of traveling between the U.S. and the U.K., and they tell me all about the same thing, that the least expensive way to do things is often on a credit card. So if you are carrying a number of credit cards, maybe a MasterCard, a Bank AmeriCard, whatever, a Visa, whatever, you want to call and inquire before you go about the current exchange rate on those credit cards so you can determine which one is most sensible to use when you're in the UK.
Oh, okay, great. That's good advice.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, pleasure.
Thank you. Because it is the case that the credit card company is going to charge you a fee.
Absolutely.
On that transaction.
Absolutely.
For doing this.
Absolutely.
And, plus
the exchange rate.
So I guess you want to see who's the, if you have your choice of using several different cards.
Absolutely.
You can find out, well, where are you going to get your best deal and then use that card.
Try to be a savvy consumer.
Right.
It's about the best you can do in that case.
Very good. Let us continue. And we'll talk next with someone in Mahomet. This would be line number 3. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting about using the credit card for international travel. One real quick story there. I was in Mexico in the 80s, and they put the peso on float, and my credit card was worthless. The money that I had with me was the only thing that got me through. But that's aside. One of the things that I would suggest for personal security is when you get a new credit card, instead of signing the back of it, put on the back of it photo ID required.
Now, that's very interesting because a lot of people do that, and that has been a recommendation. In fact, I made that recommendation about a year and a half ago. Interestingly enough, a number of credit card company vendors will not accept your credit card unless you have a signature on the back of that credit card.
Is that right?
That's right. So that is the only problem with that, and that has been a recommendation that has been out there for some time. I think it's still a good recommendation, but occasionally you will run into a vendor where you are shopping that is going to insist on a signed card as opposed to putting on the back photo ID required. But thank you for the tip in any event and reminding me that that's something that we had previously talked about.
Enjoying the show.
All right.
Bye. Thank you very much. Next, we will talk with someone in Moment up in Kankakee County, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I have a daughter who recently changed jobs and had a small retirement account, a couple thousand dollars, and she didn't know what to do with it, and she thinks her father is intelligent in these areas, and he's really not. I went to a financial investment advisor trying to learn what might be the best possible ways she could roll that into
an IRA
or some type of investment. The advisor I went to was very adamant about trying to move her into a variable annuity with a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit.
Forget it.
It didn't seem like the right thing to me. But there again, I'm not very savvy at these things. So I talked to my accountant, and he suggested looking into an American funds, rolling into something that they would have. I was wondering what advice you might give me that I can try to help my daughter along in, like I say, this just getting started.
Okay. Well, I think your instincts are correct not to have gone with some type of variable annuity product. That really is a very expensive product and really makes no sense for someone just starting out, at least in my view. Now, how old is your daughter?
28.
Okay. And does she currently have an employed position?
Yes, she does. And, you know, and they do have a retirement plan where she's at.
Well, one of the decisions that she needs to make is when she rolls this money, regardless of what investment she makes, whether it makes more sense to roll it into a traditional IRA, which basically is simply staying in a tax-deferred environment, all right, or alternatively rolling to what would be called a Roth IRA.
My thought would be from the Roth IRA would have been the direction I would suggest that she would go. At her age, I thought being able to let that interest compound without, down the road, that tax benefit would be
huge.
Huge, yes.
And I think, once again, your instincts are correct, so you're a lot more savvy than you're letting on to us. So I would opt into a Roth IRA, which means that $2,000 of income will be taxable. But again, let's pay the tax now, and let's put the $2,000 into a Roth IRA. Frankly, at age 28, that's a long way until retirement. And theoretically, one is not supposed to access IRA money at least until age 59 and a half anyway. So we're talking in excess of a 30-year time horizon. So my view would be to take that $2,000 and place it into a diversified equity index. And the one that comes to mind, for example, would be a total market index, an S&P 500 index, and those indexes are available at a number of mutual fund companies, Fidelity, for example, Vanguard, for example, and a number of others. So I would want to be in a very broadly diversified, low-expense type of index fund with that money. American funds, they have a great record, and American funds are what are referred to as actively managed mutual funds as opposed to a passively managed mutual fund. And they're one of the few fund families that have done well as comparison with the various indexes. So if she is looking for a relationship with an advisor, then she perhaps could go to an advisor who handles American funds. That wouldn't bother me at all. Alternatively, the other opportunity would be to go into a very, very low cost expense index fund, but put her in equities.
Okay. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thank you. We will continue here, and I believe that our next caller is someone listening in West Chicago. This is our line number two. They will be next. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. How is everybody today?
Good. Thanks.
Hey, you know, I'm in a predicament with my financial strait. What's happened here is I'm in the service industry and it's just flat turned dead. So I'm actually without a job. I'm going to be going in, see if I collect unemployment until I find something. But my wife just got told she's being axed. I have IRAs, because I was running my own business. And you just said you can't access your IRAs until you're 59 and a half, if I'm correct?
Well, that's not exactly the case. One is not supposed to access IRAs before 59 and a half because one can then have a 10% additional penalty. However, if you are 55 or older, are you 55 or older?
No, I'm 51.
Okay. If you're
51 and a half.
Okay. If you're 55 or older and you take what's called a periodic payment from your IRAs, then you are not subject to the 10% penalty. Now, if you access, and I presume you have traditional IRAs as opposed to Roths. Do you have a Roth or a traditional?
I got both, actually. So I've got a number of them.
Okay, well, here's the bottom line. If you take money out of your Roth IRA, the interest or the gain, if you're taking that money out, is going to be subject to federal income tax. That's number one. How old is the Roth? Is it 5 years or more?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're going to just then owe ordinary income tax on what you take out in terms of the gain. If you start pulling out principal out of your Roth, that is not subject to income tax.
Well, see, here's my problem. You know, I don't know about you, but the economy, the state of the economy is really terrible, and I can't keep up with it financially. It doesn't matter how many jobs you work. It just seems like the more you make, the more they take. So I got to do something. I don't personally see me retiring because I can't physically do that with the financial gain. And I'm just curious if a lot of other people are coming across that. You know, everybody wants to save up for retirement. I don't know how you can.
Well, there's no question that your story is a story that is echoed all across the country. And I would suggest that probably it might make sense to sit down with a financial advisor, someone who can really look at your assets, your liabilities, and see what can be done.
They always tell me to stick it in the IRA, though. That's the
Well, they tell you to stick it in the IRA, but I'm not sure.
I got to tell you, if you don't have anything to stick in, I have to have, there's a minimum I stick in there, and that's the problem. And I can't every year keep sticking the same minimum.
I agree.
I don't have it.
I understand. I understand your pain. So what I'm saying is to sit down with someone who we're not talking investments here and what is the next step to invest in, what's the next step to deal with your current financial situation? That's a whole different issue.
All right.
I appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
I'll get off and listen.
Very
Thank
good.
You. Guys have a great weekend.
Thanks for the call. We'll continue here, and I think that next person we'll talk with is somebody in Champaign, and this would be our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I had a comment about the using a credit card overseas. Capital One is one of the credit cards, and might be the only one, that has no foreign transaction fee. And so this is quite useful when you're, you know, charging things abroad.
That's a great tip.
Yes, because some of them have their foreign transaction fee is as high as 3%. And also, we found it very easy to use an ATM card abroad, you know, just take money out of an ATM machine over there.
Absolutely.
And the charges were not excessive, I don't think, you know, much more than they would have been if we'd used it in another city in this country.
Okay, and that varies tremendously depending on the ATM that you're using. It's interesting. So you have to be a little bit careful about that.
Yeah.
But
and the other point is that if you are going to be using a credit card abroad, you should call your credit card company and notify them because sometimes they'll
put a hold, won't
that
they?
Happens. And they might cancel your account and you won't be able to use it. So you really should notify them, and they'll ask you where you're going and how long you're going to be gone.
That's all great advice because I can recall that very circumstance where my spouse was using a credit card abroad, and then the phone call started coming in at home. So exactly right. That's all great advice. Capital One, no foreign transaction fee.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Georgetown for the next caller. This is our line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Sinnoh.
Hi there.
It's been bandied about for a long time that you should buy stock, bonds, well, not bonds, but stock, mutual funds, whatever, when they're on sale.
Yes.
They're on sale.
Yes.
But on the other hand, they're crazy because, you know, it was like the market was like up 160, down 160. What you say about something like that? You keep on investing at these prices?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a buyer at these prices. I continue to dollar cost average into several client accounts for current clients that I oversee money for. And I think you have to step right in front of the freight train. And you have to, again, be a long-term investor. Peter Lynch pointed out something pretty interesting in a podcast. If you go to the Fidelity Family of Mutual Funds and listen to Peter Lynch's podcast, that when we have seen these kinds of downturns in the past, where we've seen a number of asset classes down as much as 20%, 2 years later, 9 out of the 11 times that we've seen asset classes down 20% or more, 2 years later, all of these asset classes were higher than before they started their trend downward. Now, that's not a perfect record. What's what, about 81% of the time, maybe 82% of the time. But I have to believe in statistics, and I have to be a long-term investor. I know you are, and that's what you have to do. But not all your money at once. Take your money over 6 to 12 months and say, this is the amount of money that I'm going to place into the market. So I'm going to put 1/6, 1/5, 1/4, 1/3, whatever period of time that you dollar cost average, and do it. And for anyone who currently is in a 401k plan, it's fantastic. If the market goes down, your dollars buy more shares. If the market goes up, your dollar buys less shares. And again, what people forget and what you and I really know is that we're in the share accumulation business.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
And we'll just keep on going here. We have about 10 minutes left, by the way. I probably should introduce again our guest, David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We do these programs to give you the opportunity to call in and get some advice on financial planning. We want you to think very carefully, do your research. As I've said here many times, not take anything away from Dave. I wouldn't want you to do something just because Dave said that you should do it. But it's one piece of the puzzle here, and certainly call in, and I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone on a cell phone. This is our line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just a general question. What Mr. Sinnoh thinks of an investment that would guarantee a certain percentage over, like, say, 12% over the next 5 years, and this is through an insurance company, and they keep whatever is over that base of 12%.
Okay, number one, I don't believe such a product really exists. Okay, and I'll tell you why. Insurance companies invest their money just like you and I do, and in fact, they are required to invest it even more conservatively. Most of their money is invested in fixed income, not in stocks. And fixed income treasuries, for example, which is their major place depository of funds, is currently somewhere between 2 and 4%. So it is literally a mathematical impossibility for them to guarantee you 12% unless there are a lot of hidden things that you don't know about. For example, you have to hang on to this position for 50 or 100 years. So I am very, very skeptical about a product that is going to guarantee you 12%. I just don't think it exists in the form that it's been explained to you. So before I would go any further, I would ask for the insurance contract. As opposed to signing up for this program, I would actually ask for the insurance contract that lays it out, and then I would take that to my financial advisor and make certain it is indeed what is promised and what are the pitfalls of that 12% return. I have not heard of any product that currently is guaranteeing a 12% return for the next 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, etc. So I'd be very, very skeptical of that particular product.
So that's too good to be true. Usually.
It is. And then I would also, if I was looking at any kind of insurance product, I would want to know the rating of that insurance company, more so now than ever before, because some insurance companies have very, very substantial pools of what are called collateralized debt obligations in their reserves. And collateralized debt obligations really mean some form of subprime mortgages. And those are not very happy places to be. So these companies may indeed have their ratings written down. So it's the old story, when you get involved with an insurance product, you always want to get involved with an insurance company that is going to outlive you and I. We can't be involved with quicksand mutual, so to speak. So again, step back and ask for a copy of the actual contract so that you can have it looked at by your financial advisor. And probably 9 out of 10 times, what you're going to hear is you get the contract after you make the investment. Not acceptable.
One other quick point. If one has a mortgage, are you able to get a credit score from the bank? Do you know if they would be willing to do that for you?
Well, yes. Now, there's going to be a fee. When they call up a credit score for you, which they could do, you sign a piece of paper authorizing them to call up a credit score, then they will charge you a fee. You could actually go online at the actual website that I gave. You could go to any of those three reporting agencies, and for somewhere between $7.50 and $10, you will get an immediate credit score right across the internet. So they will give it to you. So usually it will cost more to do it at a bank. Furthermore, if the bank makes an inquiry, that has a negative impact on your credit score. If you make the inquiry for the credit score, it has no negative impact on your credit score.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure. Right,
thank you. Next, we go to Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a word to the excuse me, word to the wise for those traveling. You brought up foreign credit card transactions. I was in Germany a year and a half ago, and I had bought euro, what do you call them,
like
traveler's checks.
Yep. In euros.
Yeah, and almost every place charges an outrageous fee to cash them, even though they were in euros. So I would advise against getting euro traveler's checks, or, you know, I thought because they were in euros and they didn't have to convert from dollars that there wouldn't be a fee. But
one would think so.
Yeah, but there was.
What kind of fee were you charged, just out of curiosity?
Oh, dear.
Was it 4 or 5%, somewhere in that area?
Probably. I can't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm. But it was unpleasant, nevertheless.
It was, yeah, kind of a shock. Mm. I don't think it was percentage. I think it was per transaction.
Okay.
But,
okay. So that didn't work very well.
No, just a word to the wise there.
Okay, good.
You're better off with your credit card.
All right. Thanks very much for that tip.
Thank you. We will talk next with someone in Indiana, Park County, Indiana. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I have an 85-year-old sister that retired after 40 years of employment, and she had took her retirements and put them in CDs as she got older. Now she's rolling them over in 6 months increments, and I wondered if that was a good idea, if she'd make them longer term to get more interest off of them.
No, I like that approach very, very much. He's actually doing something that I highly recommend, and that is called bond laddering. And that basically, as a CD comes due, that she goes out 6 months. Now, admittedly, the longer you go out, theoretically, the higher the interest rate. But the difference in the interest rate for going out a longer period of time just isn't enough, in my view, to not continue to simply do the 6th or 12 months. So I don't have a problem with her going out 6 months or even a year in a CD. And then the key is, of course, is to shop around, because banks have different CD rates even for 6 months. It's interesting. It has a lot to do with loan demand. If a bank has very, very substantial loan demand, then they're going to want to buy more deposits to fund that loan demand, and they're going to raise interest rates on certificates of deposit to essentially buy those CDs, buy that money they need to fund those loans. So I don't have any problem with the strategy. And I think at the moment that's very, very prudent. Continue to do so and continue to shop.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Well, the lines are free, and we certainly have time for one, maybe two more calls in this hour of the show. If you want to talk with our guest, David Sinnoh, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
Something I did want to point out, and something I look at a lot, and that is how much money is sitting on the sidelines. Because a lot of money has been withdrawn from the stock market, and where does it go? It typically goes into money market funds, it goes into treasuries, etc. But usually the Wall Street Journal reports at least once a week on how much money is just sitting out there in good old-fashioned vanilla money market mutual funds, whether they are taxable funds or tax-free funds. And the last report I saw was approximately $3.4 trillion of money was sitting on the sidelines. That's an awful lot of money sitting on the sidelines that could be reconverted, invested in the stock market. That's really a good thing, because there's a lot of firepower on the sidelines, and eventually when that money starts to move back into the stock market, whether it's tomorrow or a year from tomorrow or 2 years from tomorrow, that bodes well for the stock market down the road in terms of pushing prices back up. So please don't get too discouraged with the stock market.
All right. Matt Toon is the next caller here. Line 1. Hello.
I've got a quick question. Farmland, should I be a buyer or a seller of farmland? And if I was a seller, what should I do with the money? Sit on it, or what should I do with that?
I don't think you should be a seller. I think that from what I can see is that farmland still has upward inflationary pressures. My goodness, we look at these commodity prices, I think they're just out of sight, aren't they? So if you are an owner of farmland, if you're an actual farmer or you're a tenant farmer, Wow, it's probably a great time to be in the farming business. So I do not see you being a seller. Obviously, people who are selling farmland have huge gains. They're obviously doing like-kind exchanges, trying to exchange to put off those capital gains. So if I owned a farmland, I would be a holder of that farmland.
Okay. I just didn't know, coming up, the cash rates are raising, the fuel prices, the inputs, everything's rising right now faster, and sooner or later that will catch up with the commodity prices and we'll be back to where we were.
No question, no question. But still, there are so many buyers out there who want to buy farmland that there is so much driving that upward inflation, I still think it's premature to be selling farmland.
People in our area, the people that are buying the land are not farmers. They're investors from Chicago or Champaign or Springfield. And if the stock market turns around, will those people pull that money back out of land and put it back in the stock market?
I don't think so. I think they're going to stay diversified. I really do. I think that it makes a great deal of sense to not only own liquid securities, but to own land as well. So I don't see that happening on a massive scale.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think at about this point, we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a couple of people we cannot take because we've just used our time. But we want to say thanks to our guest, David Sinow. Someone asked for the spelling of his last name, so I'll do that. S-I-N-O-W. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And once a month, it's always on a Friday, he is here and we talk about personal finance. And we appreciate it very much, you, as always, you being here.
David, it's always a pleasure. Lots and lots of great questions.